The Words We Live By. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the fifth in this series of 15 literary dialogues on democracy and the Bible, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren.
Mark, we finished our last talk with a promise to our listeners that we were going to take up next the fascinating subject of the Jubilee. But I'm going to ask their indulgence to put off that discussion for a little, because since we last spoke, a very interesting question occurred to me, a very personal question that I want to address to you.
Well, Maurice, let me say first of all that you're asking my indulgence, too, because it's a subject, that is to say, the Year of Jubilee is a subject that has always interested me very deeply.
I can't keep my question down now.
No.
I've got to get it out right now.
No. Postpone it as long as you please.
All right, now.
But I do insist that you come back to it.
We will do that, yes. The personal question I want to ask you is, have you been making any plans for spending eternity?
Oh, yes, I make them all the time. I'm in eternity from time to time. Now, that's a curious remark. But my notion of eternity is, I dare say, the notion that other people have, ought to have at any rate, is that it's here and now.
Good.
Any time that you leave the world just for a minute in a trance or in contemplation or just pausing to regard something that you've seen all your life and yet never valued before, you know, a dog, a cat, a child, the sun, the moon, the stars, trees, wind, or whatever. Whenever you pause in your life to look at something as if for the first time, I think you've stepped out of time. You're in eternity, because eternity, it's not a lot of time. It's just no time at all.
It's the everlasting now.
Yes.
But I'm going to put the question in a simpler form. I must confess I'd forgotten for the moment that you're the philosopher poet that you are, and I was going to put it to you on a much grosser level. Supposing from now on, and for all the time that is to come, while the earth falls into the sun or whatever it's supposed to do, while galaxies are born and unmade and space generates matter and matter dissolves, and supposing for all that time you've nothing to do in the way of earning your livelihood, that being the least of one's occupational urges, because much more pressing upon the human mind is the acquisition of status, the ambitional drive. Supposing all these things had disappeared and there was nothing before you but the occupation of your mind, do you conceive of some sort of plan for it, or do you just think that you're going to improvise your fascination with your existence?
Mm-hmm. Well, people accuse me of not worrying. I have a reputation among my friends for always being calm and at ease on some kind of even keel. Someone once said even that I had an internal gyroscope that kept me steady. Well, that is fantastic to me personally, because I know that I'm just like anybody else. I worry and I get agitated and so forth, yet I don't seem to. Well, to the extent that I don't seem to, it might mean, I hope I'm not being too personal now. I'm not.
No, I want you to be personal, because I'm going to lead now to the general question.
Yes, I'm not really talking about myself as if I thought I were unique. I'm sure almost everybody has to be this way in some degree. But to the extent that I do seem to be always at ease and somehow almost, as it were, satisfied to be myself, to the extent that that is true, I think I'm in eternity.
Well, then, I would call you a natural-born Sabbatarian. But you know that
yes, that's why the Sabbath interests me so much.
Yeah, but you know that the Sabbath, which we are still discussing, the biblical concept of the Sabbath, is actually a preparation of the human being for the spending of eternity.
Yes, but not later. Would you say
even
so?
Even later. Because the Sabbath is supposed to be a foretaste of Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. And the Garden of Eden, or Paradise, or whatever you want to call it, is conceived, I suppose, symbolically for us, is conceived of as an infinite time during which minds are developed. The sages of old, the patriarchs, Moses, and even God himself, participate in the everlasting study of secrets which unfold endlessly. There is no end to wisdom and to knowledge, and eternity is going to be passed in a super Sabbath of the acquisition of intellectual experience.
Well, that's wonderful. And
the Sabbath, as it is celebrated by Orthodox Jews and by Jews that don't belong to the Orthodox branch but have the spirit of the Sabbath in them, is one in which the temporal, which is not the eternal, is sloughed off from the mind and from the body. Ambition is gone. Care about one's situation, all is gone and nothing remains but that for which the human being ideally was created in the image of God.
Yes, and as I was saying last week, Maurice, this is true for all our world in various degrees and in various ways. All the people in the world that we live in the civilization, the culture that we belong to, somehow recognize this. As I say, the degree varies very, very greatly from one community to another and from one person to another. But I think there isn't anybody in our civilization to whom we can't appeal when we talk about this sort of thing. Now, in the case of the Jews, whose Sabbath has kept them, as we were saying last week, as much as they have kept the Sabbath. In the case of the Jews, obviously, it is a more intense experience and a more important experience than it is for many persons. I'm only trying to say that there isn't anyone within reach of our voice, probably, who won't comprehend the significance of what we're talking about.
Well, there's something that occurs to me. There are many people to whom the Sabbath is a bore and to whom the idea of having no occupational compulsion, whether it's for a livelihood or for the maintenance and extension of one's status, this conception is just dreadful and emptiness. People who dread the time when they have to retire.
Well, now, that's what I was going to bring up. When you said that the Sabbath is a kind of preparation or preliminary discipline for a time that is to be no time, it is to be eternity, and that in that eternal Sabbath we are to contemplate. You reminded me, inevitably, of that very familiar experience of retiring, or for that matter, of waiting until some good thing is going to happen to us. I think we all recognize the problem there. We must not wait merely. We must not act as if now, as if we didn't have to do anything now in order to earn that blessing which is going to come later. We've got to participate in it now. We've got to do it now.
Yeah, we've got to be mature when we're young.
Yes, so
that's what it comes to.
So the person who looks forward to retirement, say, or to stopping business or whatever, and has never been able to stop, meanwhile, does not know how to stop then. He is lost, and as a matter of fact, it's a very familiar fact that he's likely to die very soon.
Well, the very opposite of what we are talking about is contained in the hideous phrase, killing time.
Killing time, yeah.
That's a dreadful thing. Killing time is killing the universe, isn't it? I'm going to kill time. I'm going to suspend the universe for just so long because I can't take it. I've got nothing to give. I've got nothing to feel. And I will kill time and then resuscitate the universe at my will.
Yes.
When I've got piddling occupation to take up with.
Well, I think it's better to talk about wasting time. I believe in wasting time, if that means appropriating time to my own use rather than to some use.
Well, then you're elevating the phrase, really.
I'm elevating.
When people talk.
But you know, Maurice, there's a phrase you used the other day when we were talking about this, perhaps privately to each other. You said that the Sabbath was a day on which we contemplated the sanctity of the universe. I like the word sanctity there, and I like the word universe. Both are tremendous words, just as we wanted to substitute for the phrase, all too familiar these days, dignity of the individual, sanctity of the individual, or sanctity of the person. So I would like to put very high up for our consideration here, contemplation of the sanctity of the universe. That probably is what is happening on the Sabbath, isn't it? We are free yes. then, as we have not been free on the other 6 days, to consider the universe in all its breadth and all its depth, and in all of its power to please us by being itself. One reason that I honor the Jewish Sabbath so much, as I encounter its the many references to it in the Bible, is the assumption that all persons are to do this, rich and poor. The rich stop being rich, the poor stop being poor. Those who dominate stop dominating, and those who are dominated stop being dominated.
That's a very interesting observation. The rich stop being rich. I came across in one of the excerpts from Maimonides, the difficulty of the rich man on the Sabbath, since he has every day everything that he wants. What is he going to do on the Sabbath? He's up against it. And so Maimonides recommends that at least on that day, he should vary the order of the dishes, do something in order to indicate that he is not in the ordinary workaday week.
Yes, but think, Maurice, what he can contemplate. He probably has forgotten during those other 6 days how little difference there is between a rich man and a poor man in the mind of God. The difference is very, very slight. The differences between persons for God are very slight, because they all have an equality.
Yes, in his famous phrase there that...
So the rich man becomes equal on that day, just as the poor man becomes equal. And also, let me say again how touched I am by the insistence, verse after verse, that servants and people who wait upon others, people who have menial positions, if you please, they are to participate in this experience just as much, and so are the animals, so are the beasts
of burden.
They're
released from worldly status permanently for that Sabbath.
You know, I say, as I have said unto you on a number of occasions, I'm always touched and deeply moved by the respect that the makers of the Bible had for animals. They never forgot that they were fellow creatures.
Yes, if the universe is sacred, everything in it is sacred.
Everything in it is sacred. Everything
that
moves.
What has often fascinated me is the reflection that the eternity of the Sabbath, or its setting in eternity, is reflected in a curious circumstance that many people don't observe, even though they read the Bible, that the Sabbath was given before the Ten Commandments. That the Sabbath is not mentioned there for the first time. Actually, the Sabbath, the Ten Commandments, come in what might be called a later stage, although it's only a few months old, a later stage of the development of the Jewish people, and much had happened between the Exodus from Egypt and the revelation, the giving of the Torah at Sinai. There was the manna had been given, the quails had been sent, Jethro had brought to Moses a system of government to relieve him of the pressure of the people.
You mean a system of law?
A system of, I wouldn't say law, government, division into heads of thousands and heads of hundreds and heads of tens, the choosing of the best men to administer these, precincts or groups. All that had happened before the Ten Commandments were given. It is as though, if one can talk this way, reading the mind of God, he had not intended to come with too violent and too explosive a force upon the people. He had led them up by means of these preliminary instructions and revelations. Well, for that matter, the institution of the Passover as a ceremonial week was given before Sinai. And at Sinai, some of the commentators have observed There is that use of the word, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. In other words, it is not new to you. It has been given to you before.
Yes, otherwise the word remember would mean nothing.
Yes. Of course, it could be looked upon as an injunction, don't forget. And then on the other hand, they argue again, how could one possibly forget? Every seventh day is called the Sabbath, and at least you'd call it Saturday, the Sabbath, as you say, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Well, today is the Sabbath.
Yes.
And therefore, again, returning to the first emphasis, they say, remember the Sabbath, an indication that it was given before. And it's given in a curious way without any prologue. Just as Abraham, or as he was then called, Abram, is plucked out from his land, and God says, get thee to the land that I will show thee, and we don't know why. All of a sudden, we find mentioned, shortly after the Exodus, tomorrow is the rest of the Holy Sabbath. That was the day on which they wouldn't be collecting any manna.
Well, Maurice, how important is the relation between the idea of the Sabbath and the memory of the liberation from Egypt? You have spoken of that upon several occasions, but after all, that comes pretty late in the whole story, doesn't it?
Which comes late?
The liberation from Egypt. That is to say, the story goes very far back.
To Abraham, you mean to... Oh, the revelation as given to Abraham.
No, but I say the liberation from Egypt is an event fairly far along in the whole story of the Jews as we know it.
Well, certainly it's hundreds of years after the patriarchs had established their relationship with God.
Yes, but I have seen reference to to the Sabbath as having relation both to the creation of the world, that is to say, relation to that famous fact that on the seventh day God rested. I've also seen it talked about as if it had an important relation logically or historically or in terms of memory to the liberation from Egypt. That was not its source, was it? It couldn't have been its source.
It's hard to tell now with poetical legends and interpretations growing up around the subject of the Torah and of the Sabbath. It's hard to tell when they place the creation of the Sabbath. It is primeval, predates the creation of the world. And then, again, we are assured that the patriarchs certainly observed the Sabbath. I remember arguments in my family among the grown-ups. They weren't learned men, but they had been steeped in the tradition, and they kept on wondering how it was that Abraham was reputed or reported to have kept my statutes, my laws, and my commandments when they hadn't yet been given.
Yeah.
And how, according to the legend, or according to the Midrash, Jacob and Esau... when they were still unborn, and they were still within the body of their mother, would struggle to emerge. Esau, when they passed a pagan temple, he wanted to get out and worship an idol. And Jacob, when they passed a synagogue, and then you reflect, there were only a couple of Jews in the world at that time, what they were doing with a synagogue, and how many synagogues were there. And so they were puzzled by it, they were intrigued by it, they were charmed by it too. Which is one of the indications how among the folk in the Yiddish-speaking world there was this poetical lore that went around teasing them and tempting their minds to dwell upon these things. But there's no way I can't answer your question as to when to date the Sabbath. It's a confusion in my mind. It's all in a glow of folkloristic and textual... statements.
Well, I'm sure you don't date it at all. That's what I hoped you would say. In other words, we're talking once more about time and eternity. The Sabbath is an eternal thing. It's also a temporal thing insofar as it comes every seventh day. The calendar gets divided and every 7 days, here it is. On the other hand, like every important thing, it was always there. That was what Thomas Mann was trying to suggest, wasn't it, among other things, in his famous book about Joseph and his brethren. Remember those early pages?
On time. Those marvelous reflections on time.
Yeah, that deep well of time.
Yes, as I remember now, very deep is the well of the past.
Yes.
Is it not bottomless? Yes, bottomless indeed, if the past we are thinking of is that of man.
Yes.
And then he likens it to somebody sailing around a coast and seeing dunes and headlands, one after the other, and you say each one is the last, but no, there's another behind it. There is this sense of eternity.
Well, now, there's another way of understanding this, too, it seems to me. If a thing is true, it was always true. Maybe its truth was discovered only at a certain moment, but surely it was true before its truth was discovered. Isn't that true?
It was there
to be known.
But the depth of Jewish emotion around the Sabbath as the bulwark, the fortress, the citadel, the home, the refuge, all of these terms, also the palace, you can use interchangeable terms, the garden of delights, all these terms have been used. The depth of emotion about the Sabbath and the Jews is reflected in something that we find nowadays incomprehensible. You remember you must have come across it many times, in chapter 15 of the book Numbers, that we call Bamidbar in Hebrew, the story of a man who was put to death for gathering sticks on the Sabbath.
Yes.
Now, the commentators are great pains to mitigate the force of this apparently barbaric response, pointing out what this implied, this desecration. Thought of it, he went to gather sticks for the purpose of making a fire. Making a fire meant that he was going to rub the sticks together to produce a flame, and that he was doing what the others were not doing, taking advantage of them. And it occurred to me once that the resentment that the Jews felt to a man who desecrated the Sabbath that way was something like that resentment that union members feel today against a scab.
Yes.
Here is the Sabbath, the holy day, everybody's resting, and he goes and takes advantage to go and gather sticks while nobody else is doing it, because nobody else will desecrate the Sabbath. So he's a scab.
Well,
now we've heard the members of unions saying, "Kill that scab."
Yes. You know? Well, there was a great sternness about all this. Working on the Sabbath was a crime, was it not? It was punishable.
It was punishable. It was a crime. But people don't realize nowadays when these extravagances occur in the text, the genuineness of the passion and the deepness of the hurt that was implied. Here was a community at rest, and somebody was taking advantage of it to enrich himself, let us say.
Yes, you were saying the other day that it was even somehow understood that you had better not carry about with you on the Sabbath any instrument of labor, even a pen, because circumstances might move you to write something with that pen or do something with that shovel or whatnot, and before you thought, you might find yourself at labor. So it was the part of wisdom to go about without any instruments upon you, which you might be tempted without thought.
Now, I remember my father, who was no great pietist, but who was a folk Jew. He had the folk memory and the folk feeling. He was a shoemaker, and he had his workshop in the front room of the house. On the Sabbath, he didn't go into the workroom, but he used to cover up his workbench and his last with a cloth over the whole of it, even though he never went into the room. It was as though he wanted to veil from the world. It was in his mind that this should be concealed from the world, all suggestion of labor vanish from his house. Yet I say he was no great pietist, but he had this deep feeling that had been transmitted to him by his father and so on, from father to father from immemorial time, and it didn't strike me until much longer that there was this impulse. I am not the slave of the all and of the last.
Yes.
I cover this up, as it were. This is the sign of my immortality. My subjection to the humiliations of life compel me to do things that take away time from more important, more seemly occupations, so that this carrying about on one's person pen or money with which you're going to buy.
Yes.
Maybe you'll be on the Sabbath, you've got some money in your pocket. You pass somewhere and say, "Oh, I could buy this. Is it worth it?" You begin to calculate my income. How much tax can I deduct if I buy this? Or how much of a tax is there on this? And all of a sudden your mind is occupied with what essentially belongs not to eternity, but to time, and to the time-bound condition of man. This was very deeply in their minds, and it's particularly developed among the mystics, the Kabbalists who wrote in the 13th and 14th centuries and who purported to go back to the time of the 3rd century and called a certain Shimon ben Yahoy their origin. They were very deeply involved in the spiritualization of the Sabbath, giving it forms and poetical names and extensions into all areas of existence that we don't appreciate. We've lost this richness and fullness of the Sabbath idea.
You used the word a moment ago, folkloristic. I'm sure there was an infinite folklore about the Sabbath, too. Ways of doing things, all the business of cooking. Food was eaten, of course, on the Sabbath, but it was not cooked.
No, it wasn't cooked. It was prepared the day before and put in a place to be kept warm.
To be kept warm?
Yes, I remember. I mentioned to you the other day how the Romans...
Excuse me, it was all right for it to be kept warm, but
yes,
it shouldn't be heated.
There is a specific law about this. It's mentioned by Maimonides. You can set in process a certain work, set it in motion. If you yourself don't have to do it, let it go on. That's nature taking its course. So that if you put a dish in the oven... And it is almost obligatory to eat a warm meal on the Sabbath. If you put a dish in the oven, and the oven keeps it warm for the Sabbath, that work that is being performed is not counted as part of the of your relationship to work on the Sabbath.
Was there a name for that?
The dish that was so prepared was called cholent.
Well, that sounds like the Latin name for heat.
That's right. Calor, yes.
Calor
coming through the French chaleur, cholent, and Heine makes great play of the beautiful taste of the cholent. Now, the cholent was a meal which was prepared the day before, and all the deliciousness of the meal resided in the psychological suggestion.
Yes.
I remember how in my home they didn't observe it. My home was only semi-orthodox. We didn't have the cholent.
You mean your home in Romania?
In my home in Romania and in England, where we kept up a half Romanian, half Yiddish ghetto in a part of Manchester. But in homes where there was cholent, the bliss with which they proceeded to eat that meal bore no proportion whatsoever to the culinary ingenuity, and I'm certain that a Bria Savarin wouldn't have recognized in that the marvels which these people actually felt and experienced.
Of course, it wasn't in the food itself. It was in the ideas and feelings they had about the food.
Just heard The Words We Live By, the fifth in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of Democracy and the Bible. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.